Hello, and welcome to the 22nd Millennial 2016 Hangout. This was with Adam Wallace and also Mark Citadel, who was in the last one. Now, welcome, Adam. How are you doing?
I'm doing bloody well, mate. How are you?
It's nice to have you back on. I don't know when the last time was. It was probably that Skype recording that I put up in... Oh, God, when was it? It was ages ago, but it was from 2 years ago.
I mean, that was like the first time we ever spoke. It's funny, my cousin was here, was stayed over last night. And I remember being in the old house in my old bedroom, and we on this desk actually, and I was sat to the left and he was on the right, and he was like playing some video game because I have like a setup, and I was talking to you next to him. It was yeah, it's interesting how things have changed since then. That was back when you had, 1,000 subs, if that?
I think I had 1,400 at the end of the first year, so yeah, it would be about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, long time ago. God, everything was quite different then. Much
different world.
Yeah, well, that was, if it was after, because August was a really bad month, because that was when ISIS did the first beheadings. Yeah. Ferguson happened, which was a huge pivot in race relations in America. And, of course, Rotherham happened. So the report was published. So that month was just fucking unbelievable. And then that you and I first spoke. Not sure what it was.
And I remember telling you, because this is like when I was first on YouTube. And the first monologue I ever did was about Rotherham. And it was kind of this kind of jab at the Labour Party.
Yeah, and I've still never heard it.
I know, I removed it after like a few days, and I lost the recording. It was just, you know, it wasn't anything special, but I remember telling you that actually. I remember you describing the MP3 player I used to use to make monologues. You described it as cute. Which is like
I said a similar thing to the Duke of Durham last night, that he makes his videos with his mobile phone, and it wasn't meant to be patronizing. I just really like the idea of a simple gadget.
It's not patronizing. I just found it quite a peculiar word.
Well, I have these feelings about technology, and I think, that's cute, you know, especially sort of outdated things, you know, like an MP3 player. I mean, that is an antique. You know, they've been an antiques for about 10 years now.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. That's truly reactionary.
I don't have a smartphone. I refuse to get a smartphone.
Well, I didn't have one until a few months ago. So yeah. I've almost matched either. But the thing is that what I discovered when I was in America is that a smartphone is just a phenomenally useful thing. It's actually amazing how much of modern, I think I said this in the Leaving Portland video, it's amazing how much of modern life is now dependent. It's actually crafted for having a smartphone. If you don't have a smartphone, you can't, for example, use Uber, or you would struggle to do it anyway. And other things like that, rent a car thing that my friend in Portland was using, and also letting people into your flat using your smartphone. I don't think you could do that in a normal mobile phone. So there are these weird services that are now emerging, and you know, God knows about, you know, Tinder and all that. That are entirely reliant on a smartphone. And then there's Google Maps. There are things that you can do on it that they're just amazingly useful. And if I was going to, you know, if anyone else was going to do a tour like I did of America, I would say just get a smartphone because it will really simplify things for you.
Yeah.
But obviously there is the danger of it becoming, you know, your second brain and starting to rule your life.
Well, I think these things just do become easily habitual. Like, even, it's funny, in our family, there's kind of a juxtaposition between my mother's children, me and my brother, and my mother's brother's family. And they've always been far more like, kind of have more tech. They've always had more money than us. And even this Christmas, you know, they'll be at the Christmas dinner table, and they'll have their phone out. And me and my brother are just kind of sat there, like, you know, just talking with people and acting like normal human beings. But you have these kids sucked into smartphones. So whenever I think of smartphones, those are the sorts of the images which are conjured in my mind. I mean, sure, life might become a little, slightly more efficient, but I think socially it's a symptom of decay and of people not really learning how to properly interact with each other. At least I think there's a serious danger of that happening.
I definitely think they're interrelated, but I don't think it's causation. I think that
I didn't say causation. I think it's a consequence of something broader.
I agree with you. It's one of those things where you think it would be good to have this without having the negative consequences or connotations of it. It's definitely true. I mean, the number of times when I was on the train. Where was that? I was going from? I think, from Philadelphia to New York, and everyone is just buried in their smartphone. And I don't know if it would have been the same would they all have been buried in their newspapers 20 years ago? Maybe. But even then, I doubt it. I think there would have been more chit-chat going on.
Of course, yeah. I'd agree.
The thing is, there are huge differences even between a smartphone and a newspaper in that a newspaper has words in it that you have to read. And you don't communicate through lazily, using abbreviations for everything and so on.
Yeah.
Communication in the modern age, especially because we are in the internet age, communication, just by its very nature, as it acclimates to technology, will become more efficient and more efficient and more efficient. To the point where all substance and meaning is missing and lost. And I mean, this is just all throughout the contemporary world. This is why people complain about journalism and the media and entertainment, because all of the depth of these things is seeping away and being replaced by a kind of facade of flashing lights.
I do tell Mark.
I was just going to point out somebody in the chat had raised something quite depressing, which is probably linked to technology, is that and how we viewed all of these things that have been going on far away in the Middle East, which we previously would have had no knowledge of, we're going to be quite an interesting generation, because we're going to grow up and reminisce about the various beheadings that happened during our childhood. And that would never have happened before.
Yeah. I remember there was a guy called, was it Eugene O'Neill or something, that one of the first, but it wasn't ISIS, it was before that. And I'm sure that video is still floating around the internet. That's about 10 years ago. And there was that guy from Liverpool, Ken Bigley. Remember that?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. I mean, there's just been so many. They all blend together into one, don't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is a really grim subject. It's awful. I remember when it all started, it really felt like I knew.
Danny Pearl was one of the first ones, wasn't it?
That set
the trend of recording them, at least.
Yeah. I think that was pre-ISIS. What was his name? There was a Jewish guy, Sotolov or something.
Stephen Sotolov, one of the first. Sotolov.
He was the second one. The first one was... I can't remember his name now. But then it went on for a few months, and it just seemed so brutal, so awful. It was a depressing month, August 2014. But then, of course, Rotherham happened, and that just seemed to...
A lot closer to home, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I talk about it a lot. I still sort of name drop it because it surprises me that my channel existed for 8 months before Rotherham, because it just seems to be the perfect thing for my channel.
A catalyst of people suddenly realizing something was very, very wrong. The Rot was a very good title for that documentary, wasn't it?
Well, thank you. I think so. That's the reason that Rotherham is so important. It's a grimly fantastic miniature of what's wrong with our civilization. Every aspect, every fucking part of that society colluded in this.
But I think even more than that, it's really symbolic of, and this goes back to the issue with the phones, societal atomization. This is something that if it had happened to any degree 300 odd years ago in any society, there would have been absolute pandemonium. It would have just been insane. Whereas Rotherham didn't even get the hashtag or Facebook tint your picture treatment. It got nothing. Nothing at all.
No. And there's a huge amount to be said just about what you just said. But I'm very paranoid about the hate speech laws now. But yeah, the lack of reaction. In fact, ironically, the most reaction came from the media themselves. They had a circus for about 3 or 4 weeks about it. Yeah. And then, but the public at large are just terrified of talking about it. This is why I did that, like, what was it, 4 months later, the first video I did in 2015, yeah, was about, I'd been talking to this friend of mine who's a sort of indie type. He'd been in China for a few months while that all happened. And then he came back and all his friends were lefty, liberal friends, were talking about Ferguson. And I asked him if any of them had talked about Rotherham, and he said no. And I said, I clarified, not any of them, none of them. And he said, none. None whatsoever.
Yeah.
The 21st. What's that? The 2016 yeah, you mute that, right. Okay. So, yeah, it was horrifying to me because I just, they would rather talk about Ferguson than this thing that was happening in their own country involving 1,400 victims.
But so why would they care?
Yeah.
What motivation is there for them to give a damn?
Because it's their group. It's their nation. It's their society.
But like I said, Wes, it's a proposition nation, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just not, you know, what do they care? They don't have any sense of, nobody has any sense of connection to anyone else. And
but
that's a problem.
That is true, but I think it's an artificial situation. It's an extremely unnatural thing for one segment of society to not care about something like this happening to another segment of their own society. I think that does not happen naturally, that detachment.
Of course not. Of course, it's artificial in the sense that this is not normal. It's not organically, you know, as I mentioned, in history, this it just would never have happened. It would never have been allowed to happen, and certainly would never have been allowed to have gone on for as long as it did and without consequence. But it's not artificial in the sense that it's real and it cuts to the heart of who people are and how they perceive themselves and their surroundings. It's not just it's not just like a conspiracy, like a media cover-up or anything like that. And there are certain things point to and say that is the case. This is, people know about this, they knew about this, they read the report, and they moved on. And they've probably forgotten all about it.
Yeah. That's just horrifying to me, I have to say. I mean, because as you say, it's not a hidden thing anymore. Everyone now knows about it. And yet, if you mention it, you know, they think, why are you even talking about that?
Well, not just that, but think about how many people in that community knew about it. That's even worse. That's not just reading it in the paper. That's people who probably saw these girls going into those houses and knew exactly what was going on. And it was just, you know, that's what happens, isn't it? It's...
And the only diagnosis can be like severe atomization, alienation.
I'm all right, Jack, but what about you?
The community exists only in the sense that the biological stuff is there. Yeah. To create a community, but there's no, you know, there's nothing beyond that.
There's no, it's Homo economicus 101. People, if you know, it's not affecting, if it's not affecting me personally, my bottom line, or you know, you could probably say people still give a damn about their families. Usually, if it happens to someone who you're related to, that's probably quite a visceral reaction still to that. And I think that you'd be very hard pressed to get rid of that. But in terms of other people who people are not related to, who are just, yeah, part of your general group, that all those identities that once bound them together have been destroyed. The institutions that once upheld them have gone. They've been decayed. They're in ruin. That's how these forces want us to be. Because if we're like that, then we are ultimately exchangeable, and that's better for business.
Wow. Okay. Well, let's get back to the subject of... we wanted to talk about, or I wanted to talk about, the Plebeian podcast. So, Adam, tell people about the Plebeian podcast.
What do you want to know? It's a podcast for plebs.
Oh, didn't say that. I've been on it so much.
It's all right. There's not really much to tell. We just kind of do the kind of hangout on Wednesdays and Fridays, and we just get together and we discuss things. The general flavor of things tends to be kind of rad-trad, religious, cultural, but we touch upon politics and all the rest. It's quite relaxed, it's quite informal. If you go back, there've been a couple of iterations of it where I've tried different things, but the formula we have now is me and some guys get together and we just chat for about an hour and a half, usually. And I seem to have a good knack with people because the chemistry tends to be very good. And later, actually, on after this little hangout here, we will be doing a podcast. The last one of this year, be episode 50, actually. Yeah, there's not much to tell. I fucking hate shilling my stuff. I feel like a Jew.
Ah,
you know.
Oh my God! I wish you hadn't said that.
Oh, sorry.
you meant it satirically, of course.
Of course, I did.
Yeah, but that was actually something I was going to ask you about. Are you concerned about the hate speech laws, or do you just sort of power through?
I've got better things to worry about, to be honest. No, I don't really give a damn. Because, I mean, I'll probably give a damn if I ever get shut down. But until then, there's no reason for me to particularly, because I'm not doing anything illegal. I'm not violating any hate speech laws. You could, if you really, really wanted to stretch it, and you're a bit of a cunt, you probably could construe most of what I said over the past 2 years as hate speech. But,
well, a lot of the people at these bureaucracies and quangos are very cunty. So,
oh yeah, some of them are. But the law, a lot of people over exaggerate just how tyrannical it is. It's not as bad as it could be yet, but no, I'm not particularly worried, and there's no real reason to be particularly worried for me anyway.
Because Germany is still worse.
Yeah, it is. And there are legal defenses in place. There are things you can do if you enter one of these sorts of quangos. Yep. But
I just want to ask on a, correct me if I'm wrong, the recent law that people were getting quite up in arms about, has that been overturned? I read something that had been...
Are you referring to the definition of anti-Semitism?
No, there was
that's hilarious. Snopes. Do you know what they did? They said anything suggesting that Jews are in positions of influence and power in society also falls under conspiracy and therefore hate speech.
especially with regard to the media as well.
Oh, I mean, of course, yeah. When Ed comes back from Israel, we'll have a good laugh about that, I'm sure.
Well, they're going to have to arrest Rabbi Jonathan Sacks then, because he's had that on numerous occasions.
Yeah. Well, there you go. But these things, where's the point? I'm not a hateful person. I've never condoned things like, supported things like violence or whatever. I mean, the best defense one has is to speak in abstract and often hypothetical terms. I mean, one can speak in a straightforward way, but legally, if you phrase things in certain ways, you can get away with anything. I mean, it's just speech. I'm pretty sure most judges are quite normal people who have better things to do and actually have people to arrest who deserve to be arrested rather than kids bantering on the internet. I understand the concern for these things, but I haven't. Nothing has come up yet which really concerns me. And anyway, I've archived everything anyway, just in case. So.
I was referring to the UK Snoopers Charter, which was that recent expansion of executive authority on sort of hacking into your emails and things, and that's been overturned by an EU court. Of all things, I don't know how relevant that is. I mean, Theresa May probably is wishing she exited quicker now, but these things are... They're going to continue this kind of Orwellian attempt to crack down on the internet. I don't think it will be successful, honestly, because I think the internet is really out of their control. You either have the internet or you don't in your country.
Well, that's the thing. Right, this is a good example. Tomorrow night, I'm probably going to do a hangout, which... Right, okay, last year, the Christmas millennial hangouts were a very different format. It was open to everyone.
You just put the link up online, didn't you? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I don't even know where I posted it. I can't remember now. I think it was in the... Where did I post it? Oh, yeah, it was in the video description. Yeah, that was it. So that was it, and it was open to everyone. And those would go on for a long time and so on. Well, I wasn't sure whether to do one like that this year because, you know, some people thought they were chaotic and not much fun and all that. But I thought I could do one. But then I thought, well, holy, you know, what if someone comes in and just, you know, shits this up? So I'm not sure what I'm going to do. Because would I be held responsible for that? I don't know. I mean, we can say that it would be preposterous for me to be held responsible for it, but that doesn't matter.
The courts are preposterous, so it fits perfectly.
Well, I don't know. You could do something like, you know, say to everyone who comes in, you know, you agree that everything you say here is yours and belongs to you and is a consequence of your thoughts and your actions, not my own. You know.
Well, it would be a disclaimer at the start.
Yeah,
I'm thinking that's what I would do. Just at the start, say I disclaim any responsibility for what some fuckwit comes in and says here, some troll, because this is it. It's international. You know, how can I don't know who gets held legally responsible for what is said in a hangout where, you know, the stuff goes through American servers, but it's initially said in Belgium, but the person hosting the thing is in Sweden. And so forth.
Yeah.
You know. It's fair to be worried about these things and cautious, but you'll be fine. Don't overthink it. Just do that. Just this disclaimer, and you'll be all right.
Well, and maybe I will do that then.
What time is that, by the way?
It's going to start at 10 p.m. My co-host will be Anti Dem.
Anti Dem. How is he doing? I know you visited in America.
Oh, it was really nice. He took good care of me. He was very kind. It was nice to have a familiar face because he was the first person I met, I stayed with, so that was a really nice thing, because I've known him for
he's a good old boy. He was around before I was.
Oh yeah, he's been doing this for ages.
Yeah,
so that was nice, and he was, as I say, very helpful to me and patient. So as he joined me like, what was it, the 2nd of January this year for the equivalent of what we're going to do tomorrow night, which is a sort of networking hangout. And the idea is that, the idea was to get as many people through as possible just to hear their voices, sort of community building thing. Of how big the movement was becoming, whatever, the community, the network, whatever. And so I wanted to do the same thing this year. And I'd still like to do the same thing this year. It's just that I am hesitant because of, because God knows what the situation of the law is.
Well, I mean, this has been, I mean, even I've read critiques of this from libertarians long before I actually sort of entered into this strain of politics. This is one of the keys of the modern state. They deliberately make laws very ambiguous so that you don't know what's going on and so that you can always potentially be criminalized. And they've done it in America for a long time, and I'm sure they've done it in Europe for even longer. It's a deliberate tactic. There are so many laws on the books and things that you don't know whether you're breaking the law or not. And that is meant to put you in a perpetual state of really kind of subconscious paranoia over what you can say and what you can't say. And of course, it's administered by these, at the moment, by these crazy social justice freaks who are, you know, on the content management boards at Twitter and all of these other places, and giving speeches at the UN and stuff. So I think it's very deliberate. It's not just bad clerical organization, that they know that these laws are deliberately designed to be ambiguous and are deliberately designed to entrap people who they don't like, but also let off people who they maybe don't have as many misgivings about. You know, we can point to various, shall we say, Islamic religious figures in the UK who have been allowed to get away with quite a lot of, well, questionable speech at times. So it's
hate speech, fake statistics of hate.
Yes, fake your statistics are hateful, of course. But yeah, we just have to deal with these things. I mean, we've been dealing with them for a long time. I said a long time ago it was going to get worse. Of course, it was going to get worse as we become more visible, as our ideas become more popular among, I think a growing number of intelligent young people, especially. Of course, they're going to come after us with everything they've got. We should be prepared to confront it and be able to sort of stand firm.
Sorry about that. I was just someone was asking which episode of The Daily Show I appeared on, and I think it was either 100 or 101. I can never recall. So, yeah, it is, as you say, it's a complicated, it's deliberately muddy and murky. And the other thing is, I think it's like that, not only because they want to be able to entrap you, but it's also like that, I think, because they simply don't know how to, there is no way to legislate this kind of thing in clear cut black and white terms. You know, it's just impossible to do it.
Well, exactly, especially because liberalism is always changing. And that's the thing, it's not, you know, to a point of going into sort of the metaphysics of it, liberalism posits at the core of society something that is in a state of constant revolution and constant overturning. Yesterday's sort of things that were okay are today's heresies. Then you can see this with, for example, like misgendering people. I mean, is misgendering people hate speech? That's a question. It's a legitimate question nowadays. It could certainly constitute hate speech within our lifetimes. To call somebody who is questionably a man, it's those kind of things. You can't really set down hard and fast laws when your ideology is constantly changing, constantly finding new people who might be offended, new victim groups, inventing them out of thin air, as apparent in you know, the model, certainly sexual politics that we have. I don't know how many genders there are now.
Yeah, but it's easy for you to say this kind of thing as a cisgender.
Oh, of course, yeah, cis scum have to die, doesn't it? Actually, I should probably say this. I do identify as a civil attack helicopter, so people should watch out. So,
actually, an interesting thing about the die cis scum girl, I think, I don't know how well known this is, but she did actually become normal. I mean, there's a photo. She's no longer, you know, she's no longer into that stuff.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, amazing.
I think she's gone cis.
She's gone cis. Bloody hell. Traitor. She's a traitor to the, well, you can't call it a sisterhood.
the transterhood.
Mirtahood. Yeah, the transterhood. I'm going to hunt her down. I'm going to fly over there and attack her with my onboard machine gun.
Well, I thought it was just interesting because, you know, you get that cliche that, you know, like a feminist, she just needs a good dicking.
Yeah.
Sexist thing. But apparently that's what happened with her. She got a boyfriend.
She got a good dicking, yeah. Well,
yeah, everything was just fine after that.
Things like that do happen. I mean, especially with women as well. Women are, I've often said they're not really prime movers of things. So they're quite easily moved if, you know, decent and honorable and strong men come into their lives and can, you know, move them away from this stuff. I'm not like sort of one of these people who says, well, you know, the real problem we have is European women. You know, I think it's a problem, certainly a problem. You can see that from Austria's election results. But women are ultimately led by men. You know, we wouldn't have today the suffrage, universal suffrage, if not for men. Women didn't win suffrage. Men gave it to them, essentially. So, you know, the problem exists really within us. If we reform ourselves, if we, you know, do what needs to be done, then the women will come along. The women will follow. It doesn't matter what society you're in. They always do. They are not, women are not natural revolutionaries, really. They appear in some revolutions. They catalyze revolutions. Sometimes they partake in certain elements, but no real revolution was ever sort of designed or articulated by women. They're sort of additional.
Well, you'll find that the only people who, you know, try and blame women for everything, if you actually look at the men themselves who say those sorts of things, they're always very uninspiring, miserable, you know, unimportant people.
Yeah. And I don't want to dismiss the critique that says, you know, like with the condition of the cologne rape, somebody says, well, you know, it's perfectly why these women should certainly be allowed to tart around town and dress however they want on the street.
Yeah, but who allows? Their fathers obviously let them.
Their fathers let them, exactly.
Community, it's
the fault of the community. Yeah. And that just leaves them open to the wolves. And the wolves were in Cologne that night. But again, it comes down to the men in a given society. I think blaming women necessarily for like the revolutions that we have seen and had is like somebody blaming the Hitler Youth for Nazi Germany. They're just children. It's they go along with what they're taught on because that's their nature. I mean, it's their given nature. It's something that's attractive and beautiful about them. And it's something to be admired. But obviously it's bad when the people leading them are bad. And today they are bad. We have a dearth of men, and Germany is, you know, one of the epicenters of it. That, I mean, God help it. What's going to happen? I was actually just talking in a Skype group on this kind of this topic. You know, there was a little while ago a top Bulgarian judge who was interviewed. I think it was concerning Hungary and Viktor Orban, but he talked about the rapes in Germany, and he said, you know, God forbid that ever happens in Bulgaria. The Bulgarian man is poor, but he still has honor. He'll still go out into the street and he'll fight for, you know, his mother or his daughters. And it's just, it's not the case in Germany. It's not the case in really any Western European country, as we've seen in Rotherham, and certainly there have been other smaller cases as well. Sweden, God, the epicenter of these rapes. So yeah, it does come down to the men ultimately, and I don't think we should externalize. Neither we shouldn't either externalize it and kind of blame all our problems on women, because that's just ridiculous. But I mean, also on the other hand, we're not saying
women
are great and they're going to rescue us and no, you know, mer feminism or anything like that. No, that's got to be shafted as well.
But it's, at the same time, saying, you know, blaming them for it is also pointless, because they are not going to rescue. It's up to the men to.
It's up to the men. It's up to the men to do it. Yeah. They're expecting us to do it. I find this is one of the kind of depressing things I think we have to contend with, at least in this political sphere, is there is a lot of people sort of pointing the finger at certain things, whether it's women, whether it's institutions like, I don't know, the church in the West saying, oh, the church needs to come and save us. The church needs to do such and such. Why is the church doing this that's bad? Rather than saying that they don't actually have any control over events. They don't really have agency in this world, which is completely sort of dominated by these liberals. It's on you. I mean, the onus is on you. It's on people like us. It's on those who will follow us and those who will learn from our ideas. It's not on, don't look for other groups to fly in and save you. It's just not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Adam, what would you say about that?
Not much I can really add, is there? It's self-evident. Well, then again, well, I could expand a little bit. You see this sentiment broadly in present-day society, but on the right as well, in that people always they point fingers to those around them and to things around them outside of their own control. MGTOWs do this with women. Anti-feminists do this with women. The anti-Islam movement does it with Muslims. All the rest of it. It's, you're doing this and you're doing this, you should stop it. Or it's a cry to help for someone else to do it. The answer to things like feminism is, if you have children and you happen to have women as children, then you raise them in the proper manner. And you show them authority and respect and love and discipline. And it's the same for if you have sons and you'd rather they didn't turn out to be morons. You educate them and you teach them well and so on. And it's the same with those around you. If you know people who are morons, you should give them a hand and try to get them out of that state instead of whining. You'll find that people, human beings, and we must speak about human beings because we're speaking about society, and society is an amalgamation of human beings. But human beings tend to only change through inspiration and through patience. They don't change just through criticizing and pointing fingers and complaining. People will change when they are compelled inwardly to change by being moved by something external, often by example. So I think a lot of these desires to complain about this segment and that segment of society and those people and these people, while I get it, is all ultimately a total waste of time, because it shouldn't affect one's own actions in one's own life, because we are all a part of society in our own small way. We aren't outside of it. You and I and Mark and everyone watching or listening might be outside of, to some extent, a standard socio-political mainstream, but that isn't a problem. We're still part of society. We all have, you know, most of us have jobs. Most of us have relatives who are a part of society, and we have those connections, and it's our duty and our responsibility to, you know, in the case that civilization is lacking, to be civilized, because that's the fundamental problem at the present time. It's a lack of intelligence and a lack of civilization, and a lack of order. And you know, people often go on about, you know, talking about how nations should be when they have no actual control over the nation of their own person. You know, the mote and the beam and all that, I think, is one of the things people should consider. And obviously me saying all this right now is kind of breaking that to some degree. But there is a great danger in just complaining about women or complaining about liberals or complaining about this and that. Because I think for some people it does become a psychological mechanism whereby their own abilities are kind of squandered and they waste all of their energy just kind of pointing and pointing. So
I think it flows from substantive critique sometimes into what I'd term resentment.
Yeah.
Which is just sort of this, it's a kind of impotence. It's a kind of, you've already said this about, you know, and I find this extremely annoying on those who continue to harp on the social justice thing with Anita Sarkeesian and Gamergate, etc., years after it occurred.
It feels so passé now.
It's low-hanging fruit. It's just not interesting anymore. These people are patently insane. We know, we've known for a while. Let's, you know, let's go on. Let's chase after bigger fish now. This externalizing happens to an extent with these sort of very vast-ranging conspiracies that people construct about themselves. You know, you can go into the whole JQ issue. That's, for some people, that's just a crutch to disempower themselves and say that, well, nothing can happen because there's this massive web that is controlling everything, and therefore, you know, I can just whine about it.
Well, it's obviously nonsense, though, because who allowed the Jews to get there? It's when I went to when I went to the London Forum, this is one of the points I made in my brief talk there, was that, you know, if we're just going to talk about the Jewish question, how is Jewish finance usury and all the rest, how is that so powerful? It didn't just happen overnight when a bunch of kind of sneaky Jews got together and said, now we're going to dominate Western civilization. You know, it was a long period, and certain events were facilitated because... if we want to bring up that kind of viewpoint of Western man being victim to certain forces, was because it was allowed. It was admitted, like it was with Rotherham. Rotherham was not the big bad Muslims preying on innocent little girls. It was the entire collapse of the community in and of itself. On every level, socially, morally.
Spiritually.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's how these things occur. Bowden said something, Jonathan Bowden said something very important, very, very worth remembering, is the fact that defeat is accepted psychologically before it's accepted, before it actually happens. And the fact that one will accept defeat and failure before it actually occurs. You know, so, and that's why, for example, the anti-jihad, and me and Margot had this conversation many times, but why the anti-jihad groups, like Pegida, etc., are all doomed to failure. Because they don't actually stand for anything. The whole argument of all kind of these sorts of anti-Islamists is that Muslims are scary, please don't hurt us.
Yeah, and this becomes embarrassingly obvious when, for example, the EDL do a march through a town. Right, first of all, it just looks antagonistic. It looks... like they are the problem, that they are the source of the, they are causing the, so that's the first thing. But the second thing is, what are they marching about? What are they protesting about? What do they want to happen? It's inherently impotent.
All they're doing, they want to preserve their own nihilism, because Islam is a metaphysically objectivist system in a very primitive way, but it's nevertheless a metaphysically objectivist system which says there are rules on how society should be and how man should be, whereas these Western nihilists just want to wallow in their own hedonism. And that's what they want to defend. And it's doomed to failure, because you can't defend slime falling through one's fingers. It doesn't work like that. So what people on the right should be doing is being affirmative and being constructive and being positive and being creative. Everyone listening and watching should be involved in some way, shape, or form in an endeavor which is creative, whether it's raising a family or writing books or whatever. Building, creating, not just critiquing and sitting back and observing and bitching. If what has happened to broader Western society is the fact that people have stopped affirming themselves. Now people have stopped affirming themselves and who they are and how they understand the world. And so they've retreated to this kind of mental place of reactivity, lethargy, and wallowing in the base of self and foregoing any notions of meaning in life. Then surely the answer to that is to do the exact antithesis. It's to affirm ourselves and our higher sensibilities, is to create, again, is to be civilized. I have to thank my friend Alex for showing me Kenneth Clark's Civilization, which is a documentary series filmed in 1969, 13 parts, by this very patrician English art historian, Kenneth Clark, not the politician.
His son was a politician.
Yeah. But the guy was very interesting. But I would advise, if people haven't watched that, to give that a watch, because it gives you a good feel of what civilization is and what's lacking at the present day as you look around the world. So
yeah, that's Lord Clark. Yeah. I think it is on YouTube. I think
it is. It is on YouTube. It is on YouTube. Yeah. Hmm. But I bring that up because the whole documentary series is about creation and about building and about strength and vitality and energy, not just about, oh, please, big bad Muslims, please don't hurt me. Or, oh, please, big bad Jews, please don't take my shekels. It's actually affirmative and strong, and the whole meaning and essence of it is not negative, it's positive. And that's what's necessary at the present time, because we live in a world of weakness and of negativity and of vampirism. Indeed, that's all leftism is. It's a reaction. It's a no. But we need to start saying yes.
Mm. Yeah, couldn't have put it better myself.
That's all right.
So you create the Plebeian Podcast and West Coast Reactionaries.
Yep, and other things. But I think it's not just about external creation, it's also about interior creation. Like, I don't have the right to tell you all how society should be if I don't have at least some modicum of self-understanding and self-control, or at least the desire to improve myself or to build upon myself and to fix my flaws and so on. I mean, this is basic shit, but it's important, and people often forget it. You know, just basic lessons of interacting with the other people and living in a meaningful way. It all begins in the simplest and most basic of ways, of which we've forgotten, because we do live in a post-apocalyptic world to some extent, at least spiritually. So all these endeavors I do, all the writing and all the rest of it, it's just that's the external face of a certain dimension of my personality and of the things I'm involved with other people. Of which Mark is a part. I think you'll be on the Plebeian Podcast next year to a degree. But I think with all the stuff which Don't Write is doing and all the people in these spheres, all this creation and energy is fantastic, and I very much enjoy it. But there has to be the external modicum and the external facet of an interior change, because that is what's necessary at the present time. If you want to rebuild civilization, you have to rebuild your own civilization interiorly first. But it can happen. Indeed, it must. I think it will. So one should adopt that attitude. It should be one's attitude, just to get right to basics, one's most instinctive basic attitude should be affirmative and creative, not critical. One should have a positive outlook, not a negative one.
It's interesting to hear that from a self-described reactionary, because a lot of people think that reactionary... to be a reactionary is just to be against things and to be looking back and
completely false.
Defeatist.
Yeah.
Well, the term reactionary, Mark, correct me if I'm wrong, the term reactionary is only used in the French Revolution to describe people who opposed the revolution, wasn't it, in the French Revolution?
Yeah, derives from réactionnaire, which was, I believe that was actually during the Bourbon Restoration,
right?
Though it was a little later. So, yeah, but then it was obviously, you know, proudly adopted by people like Maistre and then later Evola, etc.
But the point is, I mean, that term was an opposition term, but it opposed the fundamental changes of the French Revolution and the destruction of tradition. I mean, I am, if you want to use labels and so on, which that sounds so special, snowflakey, don't label me. But if you want to use those sorts of terms, I would be considered a traditionalist.
Yes, myself as well, yeah.
So we do stand for things. I stand for cosmic order and for health, if you like, in the most simplest of terms. Which is difficult to express in the modern age, but it isn't impossible.
Yeah. But I think, you know, it's worth stressing, we're not sort of attached or wedded to a particular time period of history or anything like that. You know, looking back with sort of rose-tinted spectacles and saying, oh, wouldn't it be great if we used candles again, as wonderful as candles are. We're looking deeper into a kind of metaphysical and in a way theological fabric, which not only undergirded our society, but undergirded the entire world and societies all around the world. And it's that is what we are kind of tapping into. And I quote Alexander Dugin on this point, who said, "We don't struggle for the past that has passed, but for the eternity that was reflected in the traditional society. We would like our own form of that, which we have been robbed of, which was our birthright, which was stolen away from us by these vampiric parasites in the night about 300 years ago and on since then." You know, I mean, I personally do feel that we should have gotten something. We should have inherited something from our parents, from our parents' parents, from those who lead our society, etc., that we never got. We never got our inheritance. We were cheated out of it. And now we are threatened with, you know, the verge of extinction in many ways. And well, we can't use that term flippantly anymore.
Well, traditio means to inherit, right?
Yeah, it comes from the Latin to hand down, I think.
Yes, absolutely. We can see tradition. It's still there, but it has to be... I mean, this is why I prefer using the term that it's remembered. It isn't reclaimed or recontextualized. Well, it is recontextualized eventually.
Because it's still there. It's tradition, always there.
No, tradition, or the understanding of tradition, is just an understanding of order, and that is inherent to the universe because the universe is an ordered whole, right? Mm. And therefore, it's merely a remembering of the proper state of the world and therefore of ourselves as we are part of the world. Basically, traditionalism, like Marxism, isn't some fetishization of some past event or reality. We all have little bits of history which we like. I'm very much tied to early England. And there's a lot there which I very much like. But I like it, and other people would like it. Other traditionalists would be aware of and know about traditional societies, which most societies were really until about the 1700s, to varying degrees. What we like there are the things which are reflected in those societies. I mean, you get this in like architecture. So, I mean, I know like you get the old men with the traditional brain group like to moan about architecture and other pointless things. But to bring it into this discussion, when you look at architecture, you see forms and ideas which are represented in the physicality of an object. So, you know, the design of a certain pillar has a certain quality to it. And it's those qualities which are a reflection of that, those eternal principles and so forth. Again, it reminds me of, let me just finish my point and I'll let you talk.
Go ahead.
And it reminds me of one of the things in Kenneth Clark's Civilization. In the first episode, he mentioned stone buildings, and the idea was that because barbarous peoples didn't build stone buildings, the idea which was missing was eternity, and the idea that they were building forever, and that they were affirming themselves, not just there and then, but in the sense of ever. And that is something which barbarous peoples did not have. They didn't make stone buildings, and when they tried to emulate the Romans and the Greeks, they did it with not much success. But that's that spirit which you see there, which is why traditionalists bang on about architecture. At least small T traditionalists bang on about architecture. There's an echo of some good stuff there. Go on.
Yes, certainly, and I just would take from Nicolas Gomez Davi as the authentic reactionary. He says, the reactionary is not a nostalgic dreamer of a cancelled past, but rather a hunter of sacred shades upon the eternal hills. It's still there. This essence is, it hasn't gone away. In part, it's what is actually going to snap this world back into reality, because it is, the world, you know, for all the liberal dreams of utopia, the world is still contained within this firmament, this shell of hard reality, hard facts, brute facts, if we want to call them that. And, you know, brute facts such as you will get violence and you will get terrorism when you pursue these kind of population exchange policies. That's a brute fact. You can ignore it, you can justify it, etc., however you want, but it will happen regardless. So, we're reflections of eternal truths, and I don't mean that in the kind of sort of wishy-washy new age way. I mean it in almost a perennial sense, or a very ancient way, that there is an eternity to things, there is an eternity to these values that I at least believe in, Adam believes in, were universal in some sense for basically all populations for thousands upon thousands of years. And only really in the last 300 have we broken from them, and now we're reaping the bitter fruit of that as numbers dwindle and the atrocities just go on and on endlessly. But we have to be optimistic that this is coming to its close now, and we're sort of, I think, in the final act of this very sad drama.
Yeah, I think things... A lot of people like to compare what's happening now with the fall of Rome and the Roman Empire, which did take...
It's so much worse.
It is much worse. People don't understand.
It's a lot worse than that. Yeah. Collapse of Rome was just a collapse of a particular empire in history, a particular structure, sort of a way of life, and definitely a legal system in some sense. But it wasn't really the collapse of a people the people continued the, you know, in their localities. They just lived in a slightly different way, but this, they were married to very much the same principles about the world, believing about a sort of fundamental invisible world or metaphysic undergirding everything. They were not capitalistic or socialistic, you know, they were described as a kind of organic community. The collapse of Rome was nothing compared to what we're enduring now. I mean, this is, let's just make clear, this is completely unprecedented. You can't, apart from tangential things, you can't really compare this to anything else in history, the fall of any given civilization. It's so much stranger and divorced because, I mean, the weirdest aspect is you have populations disappearing and there's not even a fight. There's not even a war going on. Previously, populations disappeared typically when there was either some kind of mass pandemic or something, or there was a war, a huge war. This is being done without any, you know, there's no gunfire, there's no rolling tanks, there's no nothing. It's quiet.
Because, I think it's because our comfort is unprecedented.
Oh, of course, yeah, absolutely. We're very comfortable, aren't we? And that's why I think that that's a fundamental thing that actually has to change to shock people out.
Exactly. You can't even, people are so comfortable. Life is so trivial, that like daily life, that you can hardly stir people even to, you know, to care about the idea of their ethnic group becoming extinct. I mean, I just don't know how detached could you possibly be?
Look, we can't, it can no longer be said that we, and I have shied away from using the term genocide and extinction and things, because I think in a lot of cases those are completely hyperbolic and I don't think they necessarily help us. But you've now had this journalist, or no, not a journalist, a university professor, a top university in America, tweeting out, "All I want for Christmas is white genocide," and writing paper after paper on how he wants to wipe out white people. And I mean, they're saying it. This is something they're saying now, and they feel open and comfortable in saying it. So, I mean, anyone, tell me where we are on this, because it looks to me like people are celebrating this at the moment. It's not just something that is denied to exist. It's something people are actively celebrating.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, I see that myself on social media. You get, I'm sorry to bring this into the crass terms of racial dynamics, but you get, frankly, non-whites just gleeful at the idea of white extinction. I mean, it's amazing to me. They're completely shameless about it.
Why is that amazing? I don't understand why that's amazing to you.
It's amazing to me. It is. Of course, it's natural. They see us as a competing group. What amazes me is that it is possible and that they have no shame, because I don't think that we would do that. I don't think we would have that attitude. I think that we would have the taste to at least keep it under wraps.
Well, hold on. Let me just point out. I never, and admittedly there is a kind of language barrier to this, I never see this from people who live in foreign countries. I never see like people on Persian Twitter or something celebrating this, or any kind of African medium celebrating. These all appear to be these displaced populations that live among us, who live on our lands. And I think that's it's again, I come back to the term resentment from a book that I've just read, that these people are rootless. They've got no roots. And they're gleeful in the fact that they want to hack up and get rid of the root that is here, because they want everyone to be just as lost and unanchored to the world as they are. I think there is a great deal of this self-hatred and self-loathing among these migratory populations who are not rooted, and typically, by the way, in the West, don't live very nice existences either. I think that's what motivates it. It's not necessarily purely just a sort of competition of the different people groups necessarily, but it's also driven by this kind of self-hatred of what they are, which is diaspora populations.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that the economic thing is that important. I know, rich non-whites who clearly just
want to... Oh, of course, yeah, absolutely, yeah. I'm just saying in the general, most ethnic minority population, well, apart from the notable exception, obviously, a lot of these ethnic minority populations live in these kind of nasty ghettos where you kind of have to question, wouldn't you be better off back where you came from in many instances? Well, I mean, seriously, I mean, look at the refugee camps in Netherlands. These aren't, really, is that better than what you had in Malawi with your treehouse? It's, I mean, how much better is it?
Yeah. Well, listen, Colin Liddell is due on now, so I've got to cut this short.
Yes.
And it has been a very interesting discussion. So, Mark Sidnell, we've got your details. I've linked West Coast Reactionaries and Adam's YouTube channel in the description for this video. So I guess that's it. Adam, why don't you recap about how often the Plebeian podcast is done and what else happens on your channel?
Oh, fucking hell. Yeah, the podcast on Wednesdays and Fridays, 10:30 GMT, roughly. And yeah, in the evening, that is, not the morning. And we publish on West Coast Reactionaries. Well, when come the new year, we'll be publishing every week. So that'd be good. So yeah, it's quite active. It's not like I go through any dormant phases. On the channel, there are a few monologues and other little bits and pieces now and again, but not too recently. But yeah, it's quite standard stuff.
Okay. All right, then. Excellent. Well, I'll leave it at that then. So thank you to Adam Wallace and once again to Mark Citadel.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Okay. I'm sorry it could only be for 1 hour, but
don't be sorry, it's all right.
Needs must. Okay, so we'll see everyone later on, and Colin Liddell will be on in a few minutes. See y'all later.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.